Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson. Well, here we are in 2015. The world is now carrying over $200 trillion of debt. Central banks are busy printing money to bail out a hopelessly off-track system of crony capitalism, and an even larger problem looms in the not-too-distant future. Namely, money and debt are growing exponentially. But those are just claims against real wealth, which cannot grow exponentially. The world, after all, it's finite. But the lure of an easy fix today has proven entirely too hard to resist for politicians in diverse cultures across all of history. Romans, Germans, Chinese, North, Central, and South Americans, and many others have succumbed at one time or another, sometimes repeatedly, to the lure of printing money, with equally terrible and predictable results every time. But today, we are being asked something extraordinary, which is to believe that this time is different. This time, the central bankers are going to get it right. They will print just enough to encourage growth and stave off deflation without igniting a currency-destroying event. Now, to help us understand where we are on that delicate path with nirvana on one side and currency destruction on the other, and to understand what it's actually like to live through a hyperinflationary event, which is really just a loss of faith in currency, we've invited Philip Haslam, author of the new book, When Money Destroys Nations, to speak with us. The book, it's a fascinating mix of ground-level stories of hardship, survival, and skillful maneuvering by ordinary Zimbabweans as their currency imploded, as well as very easy and understandable explanations of the economics and decisions that drove the process. Hey, welcome, Philip. It's really great to have you on our program today.
Hi, Chris, and greetings to your listeners.
Oh, well, thanks for that. So you wrote much of the book from the ground level at the experiences of ordinary people in Zimbabwe. Why did you take that approach?
I have been interested in monetary economics for the last 15 years and have been going around doing presentations on the global banking system and how the economic world works, particularly from a monetary focus. And during one of those presentations, my current co-author, who was a colleague at the time, said, you know, we have an example of what happened when a country printed money on a large scale in Zimbabwe right next door to us. I live in South Africa, and we'd heard a few stories, but nothing really substantial. He then followed on to say that he believes there are stories that have not been told that are just waiting to be told. And I thought that was very interesting. And I decided to interview some Zimbabweans that I knew. And the more I interviewed, the more I was gripped. The stories were fascinating. They keep me up at night. I just lie in bed thinking about them. You know, wow, this has actually happened right next door to us. And then I decided to go through to Zimbabwe to interview people on the ground, as many people as I could. At the time, I interviewed 75 people in detail, and just with the goal to hear their stories. And the book, When Money Destroys Nations, is a culmination of that process, trying to document, wow, this is what happens to ordinary people on the ground as a government begins to print money.
So can you share one of these illustrative stories with us?
Yes, I think it's good to highlight the high-level perspective of what happened, and then I can share individual stories of people as they learn through it. Money printing began to put pressure on all those companies that produced goods and services and who delivered goods to the market. Okay, so it was your retail and your manufacturing sectors it came under significant pressure. Obviously, when you print money, it's very easy for consumers because you get this newly printed money and they can go and buy real goods and services. But it's the stores on the other side that actually have to bear the brunt of that newly printed money. So businesses came under significant pressure And by 2006, most of the stores began to empty. The fuel stations began to run dry, didn't have any fuel, couldn't get any fuel. Water ran out, electricity was cut. And so you had this real cessation of supply and produced many fascinating economic things, if you look at it with an economic hat. But individuals going through that were under significant pressure. Most people who lived in the cities had based their entire lives around being able to go to stores to buy food and to be able to turn on the tap to get drinkable potable water. And now suddenly those supply systems were removed. So the economy then descended into a barter economy. You couldn't. It was very difficult to purchase things from the stores, and the only way you could get proper goods and services was to find friends who had their various goods, and you would bring your goods to your meeting place. Typically, they would meet around social networking places such as golf clubs and those sorts of things. So at the back of a golf club, people would meet and physically barter milk in return for wood or a grain in return for fuel, those sorts of things. I mean, one of the guys I interviewed, his wife did all the sourcing of the food. He was a CEO of a large company in Zimbabwe, and his wife had to leave urgently because her mother fell ill. And so she said, look, just, you know, can you look after the house for a week and I'll be back hopefully at the end of the week. And, you know, can you feed the kids and do all of those things? And suddenly he was in a bit of a pickle because he drove to the shops, couldn't find anything, couldn't get anything. He wasn't connected into the networks as his wife was, so he tried to find some food, just couldn't get any food, and very quickly his sons consumed whatever there was in the house. And he then managed to source through one of his friends a large kilogram of cheese. So for 3 days he lived on cheese, and eventually he got so desperate he could source fuel through his company. So he got fuel, drove to the border, and went and did a huge shop at the border in South Africa because he just couldn't get anything. He said it was a remarkable time, and he didn't, you know, he had no idea what to do given that he couldn't go to the stores to purchase food.
That seems counterintuitive that you know, more money equals less stuff. It happens a lot, but I think for a lot of people that they're going to be wondering what that process is, people who haven't lived through that inflation. I'm certain that people in Venezuela understand this process at the moment. Why is it that printing money leads to things vanishing from stores?
Okay, if we had to assume a small island economy, we just had a few people on the island and each person specialized in different things and there was a currency being used. If we go and increase the amount of currency that's being used on that island, everyone who didn't have that money before now has that money and can go spend freely. When I ask people that, you know, what would happen if we went and printed money on this island, everyone says, well, oh, that's obvious. Prices would rise. But there's actually an economic process for that. So first of all, people get all this money, they go and they spend the money to buy real goods and services, and businesses that then have supplied those goods then have to go restock their store. But by the time they restock their stores, prices have risen. So their net margins begin to decrease. And so it puts significant margin pressure on suppliers and manufacturers and store owners in an economy, and depending on the level, it certainly begins to grow, so that pressure grows and the margins begin to decrease, and people are working harder and harder just to make the same amount of economic value, and a time comes as governments as the government prints money and it begins to escalate that those margins then become net negative and as stores begin to shut down.
So they're taking in 100 units of money for something they just sold, but by the time they want to restock it, it costs 110 units of money, and that's just coming straight out of their bottom line. So it's really, it's a time problem that inflation's going faster than your ability to run as a business, something like that. And that's why we see, it's really just pure economics, right? The stores are basically, the longer they do it, the more money they lose. They're making it down on volume, as it were. Something like that?
Yes. I mean, there's this idea that, you know, hey, we can go print money and give it to people and they can go spend it and everything's okay. But the reality is there's no economic value being created when money gets printed. So the benefit that consumers have is the cost to producers. And unfortunately, all of our economic numbers that you see measures and metrics that economists use to measure an economy and economic growth and all those things, those are all focused on consumption. Very, very little emphasis on real production.
Yep.
And so, you know, you can go print money and cause your consumption numbers to increase and everyone's happy. But on the other side, it's the suppliers and producers that actually are taking the pain.
Now, this is a really important point, one that we've covered a lot at Peak Prosperity, particularly most recently I've covered it a lot around Japan. So Japan's busy printing money and they're doing it specifically to drive the value of the yen down, and they want to do this so that their exporters get this boost, and they've gotten this big boost. You got your Sonys, Toyotas, they've had this big boost. But this is the thing that's missing from money, from most people's understanding of money. Money is not a real thing. It's a concept. And so because it's not a real thing, you can't create purchasing power out of thin air. So when you print money and you transfer, in this case, in Japan's case, benefit to producers or exporters, or in another case like Zimbabwe, where you transfer this benefit to consumers, from an accounting identity standpoint, one person's gain is another person's loss. Well, all you're doing when you print money really is you're just transferring purchasing power from point A to point B. You're picking winners and losers in this story. Is that how it plays out? There's always a set of winners and losers?
Correct, yes. Absolutely. We've in our book, Money Destroys Nations, we've tried to highlight that and to show the winners and the losers. But as an economy begins to descend into hyperinflation, there are very, very few winners. The only winners are those that export into foreign currencies. But those who rely on local supply are hampered, so both consumers and producers locally. It's an alternative path that a country can go to when faced with major debt. So as debts become due, a government can allow its country to default and to experience the pain of a significant contraction and what some people would call deflation, etc. Or they have the alternative of printing money on a large scale to pay off their debts, and then that manifests in quite a different set of economic processes, and yet it really is just the manifestation of debt default, but in the process also collapsing of a currency.
I see. So let's review this then with Zimbabwe. What errors did the Central Bank of Zimbabwe make, and how did those decisions get made? I'm going to guess that there was some debt involved somewhere in this story for them.
Absolutely. Hyperinflations are always driven by debt and deficit spending. And it was no different in Zimbabwe's case. By 1997, the country had been consuming significantly in debt. And they were in the process of facilitating a further credit line with the World Bank, who was getting a $100 million facility for them. And at the time, they decided to declare a pension payout for war veterans. And they also sent a whole lot of troops to the Democratic Republic of Congo. And those are expensive things. And the World Bank was concerned about the Zimbabwe government's ability to repay, and I think there was also a significant amount of relational breakdown that actually happened at that time. But the net result was that in 1997 there was a credit crisis. All lenders withdrew their funding, and the government then decided to continue its spending on a daily basis, but funding this with newly printed money. So that started in 1997, and it took 11 years to work its way through the system and to result in the final collapse of the Zimbabwe dollar as a currency.
Now, what was Zimbabwe like before all this began as a country? I mean, there's, you know, from the outside, after the hyperinflation, people look at it as sort of a basket case, but it was actually a breadbasket, wasn't it?
Yes, Zimbabwe was one of the most prosperous countries in Africa at the time. Hmm. They had a significant agricultural sector that exported a lot of produce to Europe and to the rest of Africa. Mm-hmm. They have, even currently to this day, significant mineral wealth and very developed mining sector. Their banking system was very developed, one of the most developed in Africa. It was a fiat currency system, very similar to the currency systems that you see today in America, Europe, Japan, etc. And it was very developed, very developed supply chains, cities that had developed around good, healthy infrastructure, you know, good dams and electricity and access to basic services for most people, etc. It was like how you would see most countries around the world today, although they had a slightly lower bank rate, probably in the region of 60 to 80% of people had bank accounts.
That's actually quite high by some standards. So what? Back to the errors then. So there's some debt. There's a need to accommodate this debt. Theoretically, they should have had decent external reserves with all that exporting, but head of the Zimbabwe Central Bank at the time, was Gideon Gono? Is that the character?
Yes, Gideon Gono was the Reserve Bank governor that was head of the Reserve Bank during the time of the hyperinflation. So from 2003 onwards to the end, he was the guy that facilitated the vast majority of money printing in Zimbabwe.
Now, I haven't read it, but I hear he has a book out. I saw some headlines where he basically said, hey, I just was doing what you guys are doing. I just was first. So he's actually casting himself as something of a trailblazer when compared to the European Central Bank or the Federal Reserve. Are you familiar with his story since?
Yes. He's said on numerous occasions, look, we're justified in the money printing that we did over these years because we've led the process. If you look at Japan and Europe and America, they're all doing exactly what Zimbabwe did in the late 90s, early 2000s. And he obviously would blame hyperinflation on other things, particularly, he says, foreign powers were the influences to hyperinflation. But he, far from being ashamed of what happened, he is proud of it and openly comparing Zimbabwe to the other countries of the world.
Well, that's a good luck with that career rewrite for him. But the serious part of this is he right in any respect that there are parallels that are in any way comparable or reasonable between what Zimbabwe did and what Japan, the United States, or Europe is doing?
There are significant parallels. Zimbabwe responded to its debt crisis with money printing. You know, there have been 52 hyperinflations in the last 100 years. The standard process that leads the country into hyperinflation is that the a government will consume in debt, and everyone's happy while that happens. It's great, you know. The whole lot of vested interest groups are encouraging, you know, the government should spend on this and the government should spend on that. And a time comes when debt limits get reached, creditors become weary and they pull their funding. Okay, it's the same thing that happened in Zimbabwe. It's what you see happening around the world. We're seeing a debt, decreased liquidity, decreased incentive for lenders to lend, and governments just like Zimbabwe are responding to that by printing money to repay their debts and to continue funding their day-to-day expenses.
They've been getting away with it for, I mean, the scale of the printing in Japan, for example, utterly dwarfs anything that Zimbabwe tried, yet Japan seems to be mired in anything but hyperinflation. How do we begin to account for the differences?
I think there's a couple of things. The first and most significant would be that money printing takes time to work its way through the system. Okay, in Zimbabwe, what happened is very similar to how it's working around the world. They printed money and initially fed it to pay off government debt, but fed it through the banking system. So the banks were the first recipients of their newly printed money. In fact, by 2003, they were receiving newly printed money on a daily basis. So they'd actually physically go to the Reserve Bank and receive large suitcases of newly printed money. And they initially sat on that money because they wanted to use it for their reserves. They were worried about the risks associated with banking, et cetera, et cetera. And a time came when, as inflation began to grow, they began to realize, hang on a second, we're sitting on all this cash, and it's all unproductive cash. And so there was a fair amount of money printing happening, and it was all going into the banking system and was being absorbed. And then a time came when that money was then released into society as banks tried to get rid of it. And banks began to speculate heavily and move away from their fundamental role of facilitating deposits to speculating in markets. So I think, you know, if you're looking at Japan and some of the other countries that are printing money, first of all, you see a lot of money going into the banking system and staying there. Second thing is that it's not only staying there. Banks are certainly speculating significantly in property markets, in stock markets, and particularly in debt markets. And you see the asset price inflation, and everyone doesn't include that in the inflation figures, and won't include that in the inflation figures, because that would certainly skew the inflation statistics. But you see this asset price inflation, and what you typically have is this rise in asset prices that facilitates a bubble. And a time comes when that bubble is burst, and then you need further and more increased rounds of money printing. So what we're seeing at the moment in current world economies is vast amount of asset speculation and increased bubbles fueled by debt and money printing. And that's just one step in the process. If we were to take the longer term view, we certainly wouldn't be as confident in the process.
So then the process, is there a stylized or extractable process that we can compare? Like, here are the steps Zimbabwe took. Here's how it ended. It took them 11 years there. Note that Zimbabwe being I think it's easier to note an inflation or hyperinflation within the confines of a single country where you've got borders, because then the currency can be in relation to something. But here's my question. If you know, is it possible for all currencies to die at once? How would that happen? So when you've got the yen, the euro, and the dollar all being printed like mad, how do we keep track of the process?
That's obviously the critical question that everyone has. You know, tell me, when is this going to happen, and what are the key statistics that we should be looking at? And I think it's important to get away from quantitative measures. You know, everyone's like, well, what's the key amount of debt that a country goes into that will lead it into hyperinflation when they start printing money? You know, and there are no key figures. They're much more qualitative aspects of the economics that lead us into this. So we've taken Zimbabwe as a case study, and we've developed six what we call gorge moments. You know, like in South Africa, there's a a river called Suicide Gorge, where you can jump off from the top of waterfalls, and you jump off each waterfall and you can go down. But the problem is, once you jump off each waterfall, you can't get back up again. So we've used this analogy to describe the process of hyperinflation. And so typically what you get is as a government prints money, you get levels of inflation. But, you know, that's inflation based on historic money printing. You know, every year when you get your salary increase, you base it on historic prices. You take the latest consumer price index. You then build it into your wage increases. If you're a business owner, you will build it into rent increases and the increases of your products. But it's all based on historic inflation. And a time comes when it's a cultural shift, when people begin to say, well, hang on a second, you know, I got my increase based on historic inflation, but as soon as I got my increase, I'm beginning to lose purchasing power and I'm getting poorer and poorer. Stop giving me increases based on last year and give me increases based on next year. So the inflation becomes based on a future money printing rather than historic money printing. So that's what we call the first our first gorge moment. That leads very quickly then into our second gorge moment, which is where the rate of price increases actually outstrips the amount of money in the economy, and you get money shortages. The weird thing is that money printing in this scenario leads to money shortages. In 2003, the economy in Zimbabwe experienced its first money shortages. And you had massive queues at the banks, real shortages, everyone trying to take their money out of the banking system, and it became a real problem as people began to distrust the banks more and more and more because they wanted to actually hold their money directly, concerned that the banks actually didn't have it. Okay, so that was gorge moment two, where money printing led to money shortages. Okay, mm-hmm. Gorge moment three was then that pressure then began to work its way into the real economy, and margins began to decrease to the point where stores began to close. Okay, that's a real cultural shift. You know, before stores were open, goods were expensive. And you know, prices were increasing, but you could still get food and still get goods and services. But at gorge moment three, the formal supply sector shuts down. Mm-hmm. Gorge moment four was when the banking system generally began to stop lending. You know, if you are lending money to someone, and a day later, that money that you lent someone has lost value. You're no longer wanting to make loans. You're going to use that money rather to go speculate and buy things that will hold value.
Yep.
So gorge moment four was very close to gorge moment three. Stores closed and credit dried up. People stopped lending. By that stage, they developed this curious consumption hysteria, what we call scorched money, where people tried to take their money and get rid of it as fast as they could. Because if you held money, it was going to lose value by the next day and you could buy less and less and less. So everyone realized, well, hang on a second, if I'm going to hold money, I'm actually going to go rather buy something and get anything. Milk, rather buy a game of golf with friends. I'll do anything to get rid of the money and find something that would at least give us some value of some sort. And it's this crazy consumption hysteria where everyone's buying everything. There's huge amount of demand, but in reality, production has stopped, and you have this entire consumption of the economy, and all goods and services get consumed. So that's the fifth gorge moment that finally leads to the sixth gorge moment, which was the death of the currency and final collapse of the money-based system. Obviously, the last two or the last four gorge moments would be typically experienced in hyperinflation, but all six are moments cultural changes that lead an economy into currency collapse.
And so if we look at Venezuela today, let's think. They're at least, it's gorge moment three, probably four at this point. I'm not clear on what's happening with bank lending down there. But it certainly seems like they're close. And so you would say that given where Venezuela is in this sequence, they are going to go to gorge moment six, which is death of their currency.
Well, they're currently moving into the scorched money phase, mm-hmm. where people are trying to get rid of the currency as fast as they can. And as you say, they've been through the moment where it's difficult to get goods from stores. Stores have emptied and there's significant queues. And they're going through significant credit crisis as we speak in terms of the ability to access capital, get loans, very difficult at the moment. So yes, they're not quite at the stage of entering the true hyperinflationary price increases, but they're certainly on their way through there.
Wow, interesting. So let's imagine that you were in Zimbabwe or you're in Venezuela now or you're somewhere else where this hasn't started and you can see that it's going to start. How do you protect yourself in these? Is there anything you can do? And here's, let me tell you that some of our framing at Peak Prosperity is that these always get sold to the retail level. You know, people at out there, middle class and down, this will be sold as like an act of God that happened and it just happened to destroy a lot of wealth. And gosh, isn't that terrible? When the truth is, if you watch carefully, wealth gets transferred extraordinarily from party A to party B. And that when the dust settles, often you find that the ownership structure of the country has changed a lot. Sometimes not all that surprisingly, but generally it changes quite a bit because some people saw it coming and managed to hold on to their wealth. You know, the apocryphal story about the bellhop in Weimar, Germany, buying the hotel he worked at for a gold coin or something like that. That people who had the wherewithal to see this coming, some of them actually do relatively well, I'll put it that way. Is that accurate? And if it is, how would people, like, how would you counsel somebody in 1997 Zimbabwe that what they should do?
It's a very good question, and it's a question I get a lot. People say, okay, I'm concerned that there may be a risk of hyperinflation. Just tell me where to invest.
Yeah.
Just tell me what must I do with my money, and I'll do that. But it's not as easy to answer. There certainly are many stories of people that I interviewed who could see that hyperinflation was coming and they positioned themselves in such a way to do quite well and they were very profitable. But the first thing I would say to people is you need to educate yourself around how does printing the money affect you personally. Mm-hmm. You know, the reality is that we all engage with prices on a day-to-day basis. Everything that we do engages with prices. When you purchase fuel, you pay for it with prices. When you have your salary paid out to you, it's a price. When you pay rent, it's a price. And you need to ask yourself, well, how exposed am I to significant price increases? And obviously everyone is exposed in various ways, but the reality is this makes it very personal. You know, you are exposed in very intimate ways. I'll give a practical example. When the stores emptied in Zimbabwe, one of the ladies I interviewed said she couldn't get hold of any sanitary products. So there were no tampons. And so she had to actually connect into her relational network to source these things when she needed them. And she said it was a very vulnerable time. So the first thing to note then is that those who were relationally connected to key sources of supply did very well. If you're concerned that your country is going into hyperinflation and you are committed to staying in your country, then the best thing you can do is to develop relationships with people who can supply you with goods. You know, where would you get fuel if you couldn't buy fuel? A lot of people say, well, you know, maybe we should go and invest in a whole lot of fuel. Well, that's fine, but what happens when your fuel runs out after 2 months? You know, mm-hmm. 3 months. Maybe you can survive after a year, but what happens once you've done that? You know, so developing key relational supplies is very important. The second thing would be to invest in hard assets. Invest it's a changing of a methodology of thinking to invest in asset-based investments rather than income-based investments. All income-based investments lost their value. Hmm. Pensioners who'd invested in bonds, expecting a regular rate of return, that invested in all forms of pension products, lost everything. Pensioners throughout Zimbabwe became significantly impoverished. They based their investments on income-producing assets, which lost value in our profession.
Now, I heard that the stock market, if you know, theoretically, you should have been completely happy because from 97 to 2008 or somewhere in that zone, I think it went up 600,000%. Who wouldn't like that, you know? But I guess inflation went up 15,000,000% or some other number that just totally made that 600,000% a complete loss almost.
Correct. Yes, I've spoken to countless numbers of pensioners, and it's tragic. Their stories are tragic. You know, some of them were enticed. You know, bank lending rates went up to 8,000%. You know, so you could invest your money and get an 8,000% return, and yet it was a trick because the pensioners who did that and people who invested in deposits at banks ultimately lost the purchasing power of the money. You know, that's part of why educating yourself in what happens in hyperinflation is so important, because you know all your standard metrics that you use to engage with a day-to-day life change. And you need to understand, well, hang on a second, this is what actually happens in hyperinflationary society. This is how government responds, fairly standard across the board. This is how, you know, the supply chain changes and morphs, and this is how I can actually profit from it. You know, we look at this as both a risk aspect and a profitability aspect. You know, there's opportunity embedded in the midst of money printing, and yet it all flows out of understanding how the system, how hyperinflation works, and then being able to position yourself to profit from that.
Absolutely, yeah. It's just a game. The rules change in the game. Some people figure out the rule changes earlier than others. But boy, it's hard to keep your bearings when everything you've been conditioned for includes things like faith in the system, faith in authority, the investments that are going up, I must be doing well. But it must be very hard for people to keep their wits about them, because our money is one of the largest social contracts we've got. It defines a lot of our narrative about who we are, how we function, what kind of social trust we've got. It's really the glue that holds a society together. So when that's fraying, shredding, that's a really emotionally difficult moment to navigate, I would think, more than intellectually difficult.
Correct. So yeah, it's a tremendously personal event, and has impacts on relationships, on the way that you do life, on jobs, on all of the things that you rely on. All of these things change as money printing becomes endemic.
So, as you look at where the developed nations are, so Japan, Europe, U.S. What's your assessment on all of this? Is it baked in the cake? You know, a lot of people look at this, go, well, there's a lot of deflationary signs out there that could still overwhelm all of this. My position is that once real deflation actually starts, should it start, our central banks are not out of ammo yet. I have not yet received my check from the Federal Reserve that says I have to spend it by next Tuesday. There are things that they could do. Where do you think that the developed countries really are in this timeline? Have they already gone off one of the gorge steps?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's effectively the timing question. Tell me, when is this going to happen? I think, you know, we as economists, as my co-author and I, have taken the view that we are confident to make bold statements about debt and money printing and how they're intertwined and how that leads to hyperinflation. We're not confident to put times on it. Mm-hmm. You know, there've been many notable economists who will predict, say, yeah, this year gold's going to go up to this, and you know, this is what's going to happen. You know, and the reality is there's some very clever people doing whatever they can to delay the consequences of excessive debt and money printing. What we can say very clearly is that if governments continue to spend excessively in debt, and if they continue to look to printing money to finance their debt expenses, then they will go down an inflationary spiral that that can lead to hyperinflation if governments don't decide to change and allow their economies to experience some pain. You know, when people talk about deflation, what they're really talking about is the consequences of debt, and allowing an economy to experience contraction and experience debt defaults and all of the negative things that come with that. That's the one alternative. The other alternative is they can print money and go down an extremely painful and much more destructive event called inflation and hyperinflation.
To me, it's always once you're too far over the tips of your skis, as we say up here in New England, that means it's irrecoverable. So a government has overpromised, overlevered itself. In fact, a whole society might have overlevered itself. You know, in Japan, the total credit market debt adds up to about $1 million per household, and there's just no way any households, you know, average household in Japan is good for that. So when you get too far out, the question always comes down to who's going to eat the losses. And here's how I see this breaking down, Philip, is that when you go down the hyperinflationary path, what you're basically saying is we're going to spread this pain across the whole population and take purchasing power from everybody who's got it. And that's how we're going to burn the system out. A deflation, on the other hand, concentrates the losses into the holders of the assets that are deflating. So that's tend to be banks, large institutions, very well-connected people. You know, you look at the fact that 1% of the people now apparently own half of all the outstanding, I'm putting air quotes up, wealth in the world, but much of that's paper wealth. Deflations ruin them preferentially. And by the way, they hold the reins of power. So, you know, mathematically, I can tell you when things are supposed to break, but I can tell you that, like you say, lots of very clever people are working very hard not to have this happen. And they're the ones, I think, who lose the most in a deflation, which is why I weight my personal probability for outcomes. Deflation could swamp the system, but my personal weighting is that you get inflation for human reasons that I can understand that are more about greed and preservation of self than anything more noble than that.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, you know, if you look at what Mario Draghi has said, is that they will do whatever it takes to stop deflation. Ben Bernanke, in his time as at the helm, said very similar things as they've said in Japan. They're openly stating that they will respond to debt crises with money printing. There's no secret about it. The major risk that you'll see across the newspapers, etc., is deflation. And yet very few people are talking about the consequences of inflation. It's why I've written this book, When Money Destroys Nations. We want to paint the personal picture of how hyperinflation affects individuals on the ground and how it's actually not such a great alternative. And we're faced with the very difficult choice of pain now or extreme pain later. And it looks like the authorities are choosing to go the money printing extreme pain later route.
I agree. And to me, it's as simple as this. If I just look at the United States, you know, and you add up all its total credit market debt and look at everything. Here's the interesting part. You wander over to the Congressional Budget Office and they come out with these 75-year projections of where the economy is going to go, because that's the input to all of the calculations that say, hey, how underfunded are our pension programs, our entitlement programs, Social Security, Medicare? And you look at this and they just have the economy growing at some 3% rate forever. And so you go out to the year 2070 and you discover that the United States, after compounding at 3% per year for the next 55 years, is basically supposed to have an economy that's five times as large as the entire world at this point, or something close. It's just this ridiculous number, right? But even by the time the United States allegedly has an economy that's 100% of the world, it means that it's consuming 100% of the oil, coal, steel, other things that are being consumed in the world. It's clearly not possible. But every number that we've got that tells us what kind of a future we can expect in terms of our pensions, our payouts, our entitlements, our investments, all of those are going to pay out if and only if we can continually expand the economy at 3% per year going forward. If we can't, then there's a gigantic mismatch. That's the thing that I mathematically, I can just look at it and say, yeah, there's a problem. The timing, that's the hard part.
Correct. Yes. Yeah. I mean, if you look at most statistical projections and statistical analyses, they're mostly based on GDP, and those numbers are useful in looking at total trade in an economy, etc. But they're not useful, in our view, at assessing whether an economy can repay a debt. If you are a banker or private equity investor, you're looking at, and you lend money to someone, you're looking at their ability to repay their debt. You look at their cash flows and their assets and those things. What you would typically look at if you were investing with a goal to receive a return on your investment is whether there are tax returns that are equal to the debt that's being consumed. And debt relative to taxes in most of the developed economies is very significant, and would exceed most private equity or banking metrics around. And so certainly it's not a sustainable thing.
It's just astonishing. So there's a math problem built in there. But what I love of what you've done in your book is talk about the very real human impact, which is, of course, what it all comes down to. So before we close up, I'm just wondering, did we make it through all of the steps? I might have cut you off there. So you were talking about those who are relationally connected did rather well. So they had ways of sourcing things out. People have thought through how does printing money really affect me? And then investing in assets versus income-based investments. Is there anything else on that list?
There's a few other things. Because money printing breaks down the monetary system, if you can provide alternatives to money and banking, you will do very, very well.
Such as?
Okay. There are four characteristics of money that people need out of money. So the first is it's a store of value. The second is it's a medium of exchange. The third is it's a mechanism of capital investment. And finally, you use money as your metric to measure how your trade is doing in your business. Now, if you break each of those down and provide services to people, for instance, in the store of value category, people would just buy cars, significant investment in cars, purely just to keep value. There wasn't any fuel in the economy, so people weren't driving those cars, but there was a huge demand for imported cars just to be able to store value. In the medium of exchange category, there was someone who came up with a unique alternative to funding and general payments in a day-to-day basis. During the barter times, typically people would price things in liters of fuel because that became the most needed commodity. And one of the fuel stations then began to say to people, look, you know, you pay me up front. You can pay me in foreign currency. That's best. I'll go across the border and get a whole lot of fuel and issue you with an IOU to say that when I return, you can get a whole lot of fuel. And those became known as fuel vouchers. And those fuel vouchers literally began to trade as an alternative currency. People used to use it as a medium of exchange. So literally people would pay for legal fees in wads of fuel vouchers. And by the end of the hyperinflation, the economy was pretty much denominated in fuel vouchers. Mm. So that was a great example of people who positioned themselves in payment services. if you could provide capital of any sort, which was actually very difficult to do, you'd do well. If you provide relational bartering services, which would be in the medium of exchange field, you'd do well. You can check it out in our book. We do cover that quite a bit. But if you can look predominantly at providing alternatives to money, you will do exceptionally well in hyperinflation.
And so that the true liquidity was provided in that circumstance. So we went to a fuel economy. I heard in Russia after the breakup of the USSR, they had a vodka economy. Pints of vodka were traded around quite constantly before they were consumed. So yeah, those sorts of things pop up. People will always have an economy. They'll find a way to get the job done. It may not be with the money system that they used to have. So with that, Philip, your book, it's almost out, or is it out?
It will be out by the 20th of March 2015. Mm-hmm. And you can get it on Amazon. And you can download it as an ebook, or you can purchase a hard copy.
Fantastic. And I understand you're getting married shortly thereafter.
Yeah, we're very excited. Married on the 21st.
Book out on the 20th, married on the 21st. Congratulations on both fronts.
It's a big moment for us.
Fantastic. Oh, fantastic. We'll have an absolutely fantastic time with that. We will provide links to your site and also to the book. And we'll get this out far and wide, because people do need to understand where we are in the story. And I think bringing it home with the real stories of what happened to people in Zimbabwe is a very crucial way to help people understand and internalize and get through the emotional part of saying, oh, that could happen. And that's what it looks like. So thank you for writing the book, and thank you for your time today.
Thanks, Chris. So just to reiterate, it's When Money Destroys Nations, and I'd encourage all our listeners to read it.
Fantastic. And do you have a website you want to people know about?
Yes, people can go to whenmoneydestroys.com. There we give regular updates. You can sign up for our emailer, which deals with money printing around the world and where the different countries are relative to our experiences in Zimbabwe. And you can find further details there.
Fantastic. whenmoneydestroys.com. And thank you so much again for your time today.
Thanks, Chris.